Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development, Friday, April 20th, 2001, hearing room 174, 1 p.m.
Gentlemen, this is the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development, Legislative Fiscal Office is represented by Robin Lamont, and Susie Huerta is our Subcommittee Assistant. This afternoon, we are continuing on with the public hearing of Senate Bill 5510. We've asked members to promptly show up at 1 o'clock so that we can get maximum utilization out of the time allotted and to give our various testifiers the courtesy of our attendance. Director Scott, thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Bill Scott, Director of the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department. Today's hearing you set aside for consideration of the portion of our budget related to the Columbia River Channel Deepening Project. For your reference in your books, this is part of the Community Development Fund, the proposed lottery bond sale. That is Community Development Fund overview with the specific lines in it are behind the first red tab in the book. The project description is the very last tab in the book, blue, and that's where the narrative about the project and the history and status of the project are all described at that location. I'm not going to try to present any of that unless there are questions. We also supply today written answers to two questions that were, are those at their places now, Robin?
Yes, they are.
To two questions related to this that were asked on the previous day. One was Representative Johnson's very reasonable request for me to present a written version of the kind of shift in funds from the former Senate Bill 710 to the way the governor's budget now proposes to do this. But essentially some funds were advanced committed lottery funds in a previous biennium. The governor's budget proposes to use those funds for general lottery purposes and to issue new lottery bonds to replace that that funding source, and there's a full page that I think describes that, and if anybody has questions, please let us know and we'll be happy to get into it. The other answer that we supplied was essentially what happened to the projects that were authorized under the lottery bond authorization last legislative session, and that's the page that looks like this, that the landscape matrix and the second line on there is the Columbia River Channel Deepening Funds, which for which there were no bonds sold because the project wasn't ready to use them or won't be ready to use them in the current biennium. Our department has provided, I guess, not only the budget location, but a variety of support for this project over the years that it's been in the works, and we believe strongly in its importance to the Oregon economy, assuming that the environmental issues and any other issues associated with it can be satisfactorily resolved, which is, as far as we can see at this point, is possible. There's still lots of ground to cover there. I think probably the best thing for me to do, unless there are questions about the specific budget of it, would be to turn the microphone over to Mike Thorne, the Executive Director of the Port of Portland.
Thank you very much, Director Scott. Are there any specific questions that need to be asked at this time? Director Scott, thank you very much. Mr. Thorne?
I believe, Mr. Chairman, that Governor Kitzhaber plans to be here in 5 or 10 minutes and probably will follow Director Thorne.
Thank you very much. Director Thorne?
Sure, I'm amused by the piggy bank. Is that a new tool that's been added to your budget balance?
You heard about our shortfall in the budget balance, I think, Director Thorne.
Sounds like it.
The piggy bank belongs to the American Cancer Society, and the rule is that if you use any acronyms, it only costs you $2 a piece. And we figured that anybody that represents PDX is probably worth several acronyms to start off with. So just dig deep in your wallet. American Cancer Society will collect it before the end of the session. And originally it started 2 years ago when they realized that virtually every life had been touched by cancer. And so that was a good place for us to go. And number two, but because of term limits, not everybody understood what all of the acronyms were. Matter of fact, out of that came that some of the departments that were using acronyms didn't know what they stood for anyway. That's what that's all about.
You want me to pay now or later?
You can leave a credit card if you'd like to.
We'll take care of that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, and members. Also on the panel that will be commenting on this project, three other individuals, and I would just introduce them now. Brad Witt with the AFL-CIO. Brad is here with the ILW Local 40, Mark Hamlin, who is sitting next to Brad. And then over on the right is Al Zimmer, who is the manager of Wilbur Ellis, and they each have some comments that they'll want to make. Chair, for the record, I'm Mike Thorne. I'm the executive director of the Port of Portland. The port's address is Post Office Box 3529, Portland 97208, I believe. We appreciate an opportunity, and I'll take a few minutes to talk about the project, and I expect that you would have some questions, and so I would plan to defer much of anything I would say to the opportunity to hear what your concerns are. I think, though, it's important to try to establish some parameters of what we're talking about. And when you take the area we call the Columbia River shipping area, and this is where the Channel Project actually impacts, we are a major seaport. When you take the combined tonnage that moves out of the Columbia River, we're looking at a port area that today, and specifically the Port of Portland, is the number one bulk port on the U.S. West Coast. We exceed Long Beach, we exceed L.A., we are the number one bulk port. And to be a bulk commodity, it includes things like grain as well as other bulk commodities, which includes fertilizers and other things, a lot of which are used in the agricultural products. We're also now the number one auto port on the West Coast of the U.S. You take the other ports that are included, we are the largest wheat exporting port in the United States, and we're the second largest grain exporting port in the U.S., in fact, in the world in terms of tonnage. So we're talking about a region that is a major player, a major access point to markets around the world, and most importantly, we serve the market. We serve the niche market that basically Oregon represents. You'll hear comments maybe, and maybe have, that on the container side of our business, we're not large, and we aren't. But this is not a large container area when you compare it to a Los Angeles, which is obviously a community of over 10 million people. It's a major marketplace, and products move in substantially to serve that marketplace. But we do serve the market that we're responsible to serve. That's a snapshot of what we are, and if you take what we are and try to project to the future about everything that we anticipate for the future, whether it's taking advantage of the excellent rail access, the highway system that exists, the opportunity to expand, and we're already seeing it in the Columbia Navigation System with a potential U.S. gypsum plant downriver, the ethanol plant that's being contemplated in the St. Helens region. When you take those opportunities and look at why they're happening because of the components of the transportation system that exists. And I'm here to suggest to you, and the reason we're asking for the support for the project is because the future really hinges on whether or not we can continue to maintain a viable shipping channel. The future of what we're talking about really hinges upon another 3 feet of navigational channel. So that's kind of the big picture and the why. And let me tell you a little more about what this means from a statewide perspective. We completed a study recently just looking at containers that are handled in Portland and found that over 75% of the containers that come through the Port of Portland, whether they're imports or exports, go to areas outside of the metropolitan area. About 24% of them actually are served or actually go to the Multnomah County area, but 75-76% go to regions outside. So it does, in fact, serve basically the rest of the state. Chair, I suspect by the look that if the governor has arrived, I'm accustomed to deferring to his presence.
Thank you very much.
Whenever you would suggest, I'd be pleased to interrupt the comments if you think that's appropriate.
Perhaps we could go ahead and invite the governor to come forward, Director Thorne.
I really think that'd be a good idea, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much.
Sir?
How are you? Welcome, Governor Kitzer. How are you? Honor us with your presence here today. Thank you very much for coming.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, for the record, John Kitzer, Governor of the State of Oregon. If I might represent Butler, you need to be careful about who's deferring to who, because you may be dealing with this gentleman in about 2 years. So,
Well, I have to tell him buenos dias at that time, then, sir.
Let's see. We see.
See. Yeah, we did that together. Thank you.
I'm here today to express my strong support for the proposed lottery bonding for the Columbia River Channel Deepening Project. I support this project because I think of the critical nature of the economic contribution this will make to the state's economy, as long as the proposed project and the dredging that accompanies it complies with all relevant state and federal environmental impacts. Oregon, as you know, is a trade-dependent state, and we need direct access to world markets in order to be competitive in today's global marketplace. This project will help us retain our shipping links to the rest of the world. The funding in my recommended budget is in the form of lottery-backed bonds because this project is important for the entire state and I believe helps bridge urban interests as well as rural interests. In rural areas, this project will keep rates competitive by keeping transportation costs down. It will also help sustain our natural resource-based industries such as grain, food processing, and wood products. I think it's important for us to remember that the Port of Portland is the portal for the entire state in terms of our export economy. In urban Oregon, the project is important because of the jobs it will provide. There are 7,000 direct jobs and many more indirect jobs that depend on the Port of Portland. The state, as you know, has a very proud tradition of environmental protection, and I have a long record of advocacy for a sound environmental stewardship, and I assure you that I would not be supporting this project if I did not believe that it could be done in a way that meets the stringent standards under both state and federal law to protect water quality, coastal zone resources, and the species. I believe this project can accomplish that consistent with state and federal environmental laws, and I'm committed to helping resolve the remaining issues to allow this project to move forward. The remaining issues, environmental issues, that stand between this project and the green light include state water quality certification, federal ESA consultation, and coastal zone management consistency. A new process is underway, which I'm sure you're aware, that should lead to a new biological opinion by the National Marine Fisheries Service and by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The Department of Environmental Quality is working with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and others to protect the requirements to meet water quality standards. The Department of Land Conservation and Development is also working with the Corps to meet coastal zone management program requirements. And my office will continue to work with all of the parties to resolve these outstanding issues. So in summary, I urge you to support the $25.1 million in lottery-backed bonds for this important project. Funding for the project will not be released, I emphasize, will not be released until all of the necessary authorizations and agreements are in place and the state of Washington has provided their cost share match. I was impressed the other day about the importance of a cargo service out of the Port of Portland. I had a recent visit with Nike, one of our few remaining Oregon-based global companies, And I was under the impression that a great deal of their export material went out by air cargo. But in fact, the vast majority of it goes out on shipping lines. And I do think that if we approach this with the attitude that we can find a win-win here, we can develop a way to deepen the channel in a way that is consistent with state and federal environmental laws, that we will be serving the best interests of the state, not only urban Oregon, but rural Oregon as well. Thank you.
Questions for Governor Kitzhaber? You're going to make it easy on you today, Governor. Is that fantastic?
Governor, what's the status of talking with Governor Locke about the mask?
I think that Washington State was moving in a positive direction until the change in the biological opinion occurred, was it three, four months ago? About August, and things kind of stopped at that point. So I think when the new biologic opinion is presented, it's my belief that Washington State will engage productively in this effort.
Are they selling bonds in that regard to raise their matching share, Governor?
I don't know, Mr. Chair. Although they have a better fiscal picture than we do.
Are there other questions for Governor Kitzhaber? We do appreciate you being here and participating. We understand that the federal government certainly stands in ready, willing, and able, and they don't have to print bonds for theirs. They just print money. Mm-hmm. So I think it would just be that we get past, as you say, that all of the other issues, the federal quality, water quality, and the ESA issues, to remain and then pass out the necessary additional 25. So I understand we did pass last session, as I recall, in 710, we passed 25 million at that time. Those remain as to the port, remain on issue. And so we just need to go ahead and approve the second portion of this and then move forward in that direction, is my understanding. And then, as I say, but do you have any sense of where the federal government is relative to the federal water quality and the ESC issues?
Mr. Chair, I'll be traveling to Washington, D.C. on May 1st, and on the 2nd we'll be having meetings with all of the relative cabinet secretaries on a number of issues, one of which will be the status of the channel deepening project.
You're optimistic at this point.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much. Further questions? If not, thank you so much for coming, Governor.
Chair.
We appreciate it. Director Thorne, thank you very much for allowing the Governor to pick in for us there. Well, I also wanted to mention that Representative Ringo, there is a third Democrat that came from Eastern Oregon that moved over on this side of the state. And we've had opportunity to meet at least a couple of Democrats from Eastern Oregon, and the governor used to come out once every 4 years to identify so we could be able to tell what a Democrat really looked like. Those were the governor's own words.
Sure, I'll try to pick up where I left off. And as you recall, where I was talking about the containers. That's one aspect. We, as a part of that review that I was referring to, where we identified where the product was going, we also attempted to look at what that meant on an annual basis, the cost of just shipping, just the cost of putting a container on a truck and taking it a distance, whatever it may be. And that's $68 million a year that having a bill of lading in Portland represents to Oregon shippers. And I thought it would be helpful, just since there are some members here from around the state in Jackson County, that equates to $1.8 million a year. In Linn County, it's $4.7 million. In Umatilla-Morrow County, is $7.9 million, interestingly enough. Washington County, about $2.1. A lot of the Washington County products that are associated with the technology industry, more of those tend to move by air, and this does not pick that up. That's just the cost of just the road cost, if you will, and that's the least cost that you can enter. So what I'm trying to say is that this project has an impact that basically spans the whole state. Yes.
I didn't hear Columbia and Clatsop.
Quite candidly, I did not pick those numbers out because I didn't have them in the study, but I can tell you it's a lesser amount than that amount. But clearly, as I pointed out earlier, particularly in Columbia County with the new projects that are coming on, part of the reason they're coming there is because there is access by water, particularly the gypsum plant, and so that will tend to provide an opportunity that would not have been there in the first place. The other benefits that I talked about is grain, and that none of these numbers impact the grain situation. The project itself, Mr. Chair, anticipates about $1.25 savings per ton of grain. Now, that may not sound like much, but if you convert that to a bushel of wheat, which I'm familiar with, that's probably in the neighborhood of 4 cents a bushel. 4 cents a bushel is enough to make a difference in a sale in the world market. And that's a direct cost advantage just from having the greater depth to make the vessel loads more efficient. If I were asked the question, what if you wanted to try to do something in this state to assure yourselves the opportunity for a stable long-term economy, one of the first things that I would put on that list is to make sure that there's good transportation systems. For a state like ours that's spread over such a vast area, transportation is probably as important to our economic future as any one thing I can think of. And there's three principles that I say that from. First of all, the principle of what happens if you don't have it. And I recall a conversation I had several years ago with Mike Namas, Representative Patridge from down in your part of the country, when the bill of lading that they were depending upon to ship fruit from their facilities in southern Oregon to Europe was lost. And just the loss of that bill of lading through the Port of Portland immediately cost them another $400 per container of fruit going to Europe. That in itself then means that their ability to compete in that market, in the European market, is obviously brought into question, and they ultimately did not continue to ship product. That's a case where you lost part of the system. There are examples where the system actually, because of good transportation opportunity, gives you a chance to actually improve the economy. A couple of examples, three examples I'd like to cite there have to do with, number one, Brightwood Lumber and Madras. In that particular case, because of efficient transportation systems today, logs are being imported from New Zealand to Portland, trucked to Madras, processed, turned around, put back on a truck, and brought to Portland and shipped by container, sometimes to Japan, to use in molding and in finished lumber. That would not happen if there was not a good, in that case, transportation connection to make it happen. Cascade Wood Products in White City is another example, and probably the biggest example is Les Schwab Tires, a company that keeps its headquarters in Prineville for one fundamental reason. The fact is that Portland offers a bill of lading that provides them to compete the source of their products against the Puget Sound. Because there is a choice, they get the same race laid into Prineville as they would from Portland versus coming in from the Puget Sound, and that enables them to keep their corporate headquarters in Prineville because those tires are laid there at the same cost. And that's a case where a transportation system not only provides an opportunity to diversify the economy, which is in everybody's best interest, but keeps a company extremely competitive and viable. The third principle is the new opportunity. And I recall sitting in your chairs a few years ago when we were debating whether or not you could burn 300,000 acres of grass straw in the Willamette Valley or whether you burned less. Today, you don't have that problem. It's almost non-existent, and the reason that's the case is because efficient transportation systems now allow straw that's baled out of the grass straw fields in the Willamette Valley to be shipped to Japan efficiently enough that it can find a market in, as an animal feed market, and we've solved another problem because of good transportation. Those are examples of how important I think this project is. If we don't do it today, will it all go away immediately? The answer is no, but over time it will go away. And that's really what we're talking about when we talk about the future of this project. Finally, let me conclude by just saying that, as the governor mentioned, the environmental issues will be dealt with. They've been dealt with from the beginning for over 10 years. We've been studying the project, and we're committed to not only take care of any impacts that the project has, but in fact go beyond that to actually restore wetlands, reestablish habitat area. 38 miles of spawning areas will be reestablished as an effort to make this a win-win project, both from the environmental perspective as well as from the commercial perspective. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to respond to any questions and ask your support for the funding request.
Thank you, Director. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Thorne. I guess one of the questions that I've heard raised repeatedly is an issue that you've touched on. You said, will it go away right away? No, but it will over time. The channel that plan that you're proposing to take the depth of the shipping lane down another 3 feet
right.
to accommodate current ships. I'm told that the next generation of big ships that will ply the Pacific are already being developed that would have a draft down to 50 feet. What's three accomplished right now? I mean, how long does three last for before we're looking at seven or 10?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, very good question. What is, you know, in essence, when do we know we have adequate capacity? I just happened to receive yesterday a copy of the Journal of Commerce weekly April 2nd through 8th publication. And I'll read a minute a quote that was here, but my answer is going to essentially be that the bigger vessels that you're referring to will be vessels that will generally run in those trade corridors, albeit a Singapore to Los Angeles or a Hong Kong to Los Angeles, the major trade routes where essentially a large vessel goes from one marketplace to another, back and forth. What we're talking about in the Pacific Northwest and what we've seen always heretofore and what I predict will be the case in the future and how this project is constructed is basically under the realization that those vessels in all likelihood will not come into the Pacific Northwest. In fact, and here's the quote I'd like to just leave you with. K-Line is one of the carriers that calls Portland. And the quote is, the headline is, K-Line executive questions the mega ships. If you allow me to read, if I could, if that was okay, Mr. Chair. Carriers should, and the quote is, seriously consider whether the move to huge container ships is beneficial, said Mr. Wakabayashi, executive vice president of K-Line. This is more than just a market of a matter of ship size and results of a simple calculation resulting in economics of scale, Wakabayashi said at a container conference in London. He said, we must plan with consideration of terminal size, yard space, gantry crane productivity, classic logistics, computer systems, and inland transportation. They have ordered 5 or 12 new vessels that are the 5,500 TEU class. What Mr. Wakabayashi is saying is that there is a limit to vessel size in many of the markets, and you have to consider all of the factors when you take into consideration vessel size. The 5,500 TEU size that he's referring to is essentially that size which Evergreen was bringing to Portland and made a decision, announced it to discontinue service in June. We see that as probably the upper limit of vessels that will conceivably come into the Portland market in the foreseeable future. We started this study over 10 years ago. We still believe that for the economics of matching size with the other logistics and particularly the market here, we think that we're serving a niche that this channel project will carry us well into the future on.
Ringo.
Thank you. Part of the benefit from the port is jobs in Portland, and part is jobs in the rest of the part of the state, or the grain that you mentioned. And I'm wondering if you can give me some sort of estimate as to which part benefits more. Is it in terms of jobs? If we increase the depth by 3 feet, are you going to have some job creation in Portland, but more in other parts of the state?
Chair, I'll try to answer the question, Representative Ringo. First of all, we have done a lot of review of what the job implication is, and there will be others specifically. Mr. Witt will give you some comments specifically about job numbers. I can give those also, but I know he was planning to cover
that.
I would let him do that, but I'd be happy to tell you that that we've also done the studies. I think the important thing to consider when we look at this project, it's not so much a question of trying to develop new jobs. What we're really concerned about is retaining first and foremost what we've got. When Delta Airlines left Portland earlier this year, with that went some jobs, and with that went opportunity. And what we're talking about in this project, first and foremost, is retaining what we've got, keeping the access that Oregon shippers have today, and that's at stake. So if you say that 1 in 4 jobs or 1 in 5 jobs in the metropolitan area, whatever the number is you want to use, and I think it's probably in the Multnomah County, Tri-County area, Clark County is probably more in the 1 to 4, could be as much as a couple hundred thousand jobs in some way or another touched by what goes on in terms of sea trade. Why then, or trade in general, then what you're talking about is creating an environment that will keep those job opportunities in place. Going to the future, I think much of
budget note number 2 directs the board to report back to the emergency board no later than July 1st, 2002 on the progress towards reducing the complaint investigation backlog, specifically the sexual misconduct cases. Furthermore, the board is expected to report at the same meeting on the progress and development of practice guidelines if they continue in that effort. And I believe there's some a proposal to amend the language of this to include some additional reporting back to the emergency board.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator, you is recognized.
I would like to suggest adding language to say at the end, adoption of practice guidelines consistent with statutory requirements. And then the board is encouraged to form a work group of two associations to iron out differences and conflict, and with participation of dispute resolution to help with the resolution. I'm just thinking of it.
No, I appreciate that. And so, and let me ask this, if we talk about subgroups of the various chiropractic disciplines should be represented in that dispute resolution format to facilitate.
People wonder that if we just continue to scrutinize and study and litigate this project, if we won't sooner see a Major League Baseball team in Portland before the completion of this project. And baseball's been around a long time, but those of us who work on the waterfront realize that the waterfront for us is a lot more profitable. We have played a part in similar projects up and down the West Coast, most recently in Oakland, California, and in Coos Bay. In Coos Bay, I spent 4 years as the Port Commissioner there, experiencing many of the same problems and issues that this project is confronted with today. And while our jobs hinge on the completion of channel deepening projects, the ILWU does not take the process lightly. We believe environmental laws and concerns should be lawfully and rightfully addressed, and at this time we believe they have been. Lord Bowen once said that a metaphysician is a man who goes into a dark cellar at midnight without a light to look for a black cat that is not there. And sometimes those of us in labor view those critical to this project, and to paraphrase, is going into a dark cellar at midnight without a light to look for a black cat that is not there and identifying one anyway. Many of these questions are legitimate, but frankly, we don't feel others are not. We reject the premise suggesting that in any event, any single entity cannot recognize a direct economic benefit that the project may legitimately be opposed. And we look forward to the issuance of a new biological opinion next year. We concede that no labor force or union possesses more self-interest in this project than the ILWU. We work from Bellingham to San Diego. We work in Los Angeles, and we work in Seattle. We can travel to other ports, or we can transfer permanently to other ports. But we are Oregonians. We value our quality of life, and we believe this project protects our quality of life environmentally and economically. For those of us in Portland, our economic future rests in the successful completion of this project. There are 600 ILWU members in Portland alone. Those 600 families represent $49 million in yearly income. We have excellent health insurance, and we pay good taxes. For a number of reasons, Oregon's smaller ports are suffering. ILWU members from Coos Bay, Newport, and Astoria travel frequently to Portland to work. They take those dollars back to those local economies. This is not a Portland issue. This is a state issue, and it's a regional issue. Recently, Secretary of Transportation Minotta testified before the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee, and he said in written testimony, and I quote, "Our marine transportation system is one of the nation's vital links, with about 90% of our international trade and a significant portion of domestic trade carried by water. International trade is an essential component in the growth of the U.S. economy, but it is already creating severe congestion at our ports and on our highways, and the volume is expected to double by the year 2020. We believe the Port of Portland's future is bright. We have space to expand. And because of increasing trade opportunities, we believe ultimately that all of Oregon's ports will benefit from this project. We want to express our appreciation to Governor Kitzhaber for his support. And again, the International Longshoremen Warehousing Union thanks the legislature for its past, and we hope renewed support and commitment for the Columbia River Channel Deepening Project through the 2001-2003 biennium. And thank you for the opportunity to speak. I'd be happy to answer
Hamlin, any questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. I think next for invited testimony, Keith Levitt and Diane Perry. State your name for the record, please. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Diane Perry. I'm here today as senior project manager for this project, representing the ports that are the sponsoring ports. I'm jointly funded between the states of Oregon and Washington. On the Washington side, by the sponsoring ports of Port of Longview, Port of Coalama, Port of Vancouver, and Port of Woodland. And on the Oregon side, my sponsors are the Port of St. Helens and the Port of Portland. I came today not with prepared testimony, but really just to answer three questions and then respond to any questions that you all might have. First and foremost, to briefly describe the project in terms of where it is today and kind of put it in perspective. Secondly, to spend a few minutes talking about where are we in terms of getting to completion of the project. It's a bi-state and federal project, and we have a series of milestones that we have to meet in order to get to completion. And then finally, to talk about the process that we're in right now in terms of answering the environmental questions. There's an unusual and interesting, and we hope, process that will answer all of the questions that have been raised about the project from an environmental standpoint. So with that in mind, I understand we have just a few minutes, and so I'll briefly go through these points. First of all, when you talk about the Columbia River Navigation Channel as it exists today, in a river that's roughly from 2,000 feet wide to 4 to 5 miles right at the estuary, the actual navigation channel is only 600 feet wide and 40 feet deep. So when we talk about deepening the navigation channel, when you consider the width of the river and the fact that the channel exists, and then you look at the bottom of it, it's a very active environment. There's a lot of flow in the Columbia River. So the bottom is always moving with a series of sand waves, just as you see on the beach. When you look at the cross-section of the river and talk about what we're talking about today, we're talking about taking off the tops of those sand waves. The actual project at this point in time involves only the Columbia River. The Willamette has been delayed. because of the Superfund listing and any construction on the Willamette would happen at some point in the future, assuming there is a cleanup plan and those pieces can be integrated. So we're only here today talking about 106 miles on the Columbia River. As it stands, construction on the Columbia River basically yields a 1.9 to 1 benefit to cost ratio for construction of this project. The Corps of Engineers conducted a five-year feasibility study that looked at both the environmental implications of the project as well as the economics, doing everything from looking at what the future fleet size looks like, what the cargo commodity projections are, what's expected in other ports around the world, and coming up with a 1.9 to 1 benefit to cost ratio. From the standpoint of engineering the project to accommodate environmental concerns from the beginning, the premise was to avoid impacts in the first place, where we couldn't avoid those impacts to minimize them, and where we couldn't do anything else than to mitigate for them. To that end, among the changes that were made in the project over the way the channel is operated today is that the disposal plan for construction of the project moves about 67% of the material upland behind berms. In the past, there's been a practice called beach nourishment where material is dredged and then placed along the beaches. It subsequently, over years, erodes away and then is placed on the beaches again. Or there's what they call flow lane disposal, where material is actually disposed in the flow lanes. For the construction of this project, because of concern with endangered species, the plan actually shifts so that disposal occurs upland behind berms for 67% of the material that would be dredged for construction. That's basically about 19 million cubic yards total that it would take to construct the project. When you look at the amount of maintenance dredging that occurs today simply to maintain the 40-foot project, we remove 5 to 6 million cubic yards per year of material as it stands. So the construction of the project equals about 3 years' worth of maintenance. Over time, because of the shift in disposal practices, about 26 million cubic yards less material would have to be dredged over the life of the project. We would see maintenance go to 4 to 5 million cubic yards per year. And so the intent, both from the standpoint of concern about any stranding or warming of the water, as well as the long-term less impact on the environment, the intent of the actual design was to reduce the impact on the environment. There were wetland areas that were identified as being impacted, about 20 acres of wetland, 67 acres of riparian habitat, 200 acres of agricultural land will be impacted by the project. That is mitigated for by about 736 acres that will be put into permanent green space and managed for wildlife protection. In addition to that, the sponsors started looking around the country about midway through the feasibility study, looking for opportunities where dredged material had been used beneficially, and in particular focused on the Houston-Galveston channel and the work that they had done there, where they were taking dredged material and basically putting it, establishing it in a way where seagrasses could be planted, and they were restoring saltland marshes. We came back and asked the Corps of Engineers to work with U.S. Fish and Wildlife, National Marine Fisheries Service, Oregon and Washington Fish and Wildlife, DEQ and DOE, and study and see, are there opportunities to beneficially use the material here? They came up with a number of projects that are referred to in the project now as the ecosystem restoration components. It's about $5.6 million worth of ecosystem restoration that encompasses three things. One, it would restore, as Brad Witt mentioned earlier, access to about 38 miles of spawning streams by putting fish gates within tide gates. The second component is the restoration of water flow to about 1,250 acres at Shillipoo Lake. That's next to the Vancouver Wildlife Refuge, and the water flow, the dikes would be breached and water flow would be restored to that area. It would be managed for wildlife. And the third component is what's called embayment circulation restoration. It's areas in the river where dredging has occurred over time and it's eroded away, so it's shallow. Fish can get in there but perhaps can't get out, or the water warms. And so the intent is to restore the circulation in a way that it protects small fish. Those were the three components that we were able to get recommendations for from the wildlife agencies. So that briefly describes the project. The second piece I wanted to talk about is what does it take to complete this project? What are the steps that we have to go through? First and foremost, we needed to complete a feasibility study, and the Corps of Engineers had to find that it was in the national interest for the project to go forward. They came up with a 1.9-to-1 benefit-to-cost ratio for the project and estimated that over time, the annual transportation cost savings to the region and the nation is $34.4 million. And that's an estimate that is, from our point of view, a very conservative estimate, but it takes into account four commodities, wheat, corn, barley, and containers, and then looks at the transportation benefits over time. The ports have done other economic studies and identified in Oregon, for instance, a $1 billion personal income estimate in terms of the implications of trade for the region. We've looked at job impacts for all of the sponsoring ports and the beneficial impacts there, and some of those figures are in the testimony that I gave you. But anyway, moving from the feasibility study, we have to have a positive recommendation from the Corps. We have to have an authorization from Congress. We have to have a positive chief's report from the Corps of Engineers. We need to get a biological opinion from the National Marine Fisheries Service that is favorable to the project. We have to have certifications, Clean Water Act and coastal zone consistency determinations from the states of Oregon and Washington. We have to secure the disposal sites. We have to enter into an agreement with the Corps of Engineers for the life of the project that will be in terms of what our sponsor responsibilities are. And then finally, we have to get what's called a record of decision from the Corps of Engineers. It's the final legal step they take to authorize the project, and then it can go forward. So those are the steps. We do have an authorization. The project's been authorized. The feasibility study's completed. We have a positive chief's report. We had a biological opinion, and in August of last year, that was withdrawn by National Marine Fisheries in order to reevaluate some information, reevaluate their position on the project based on new information they received. That process has led to a reconsultation, which is going on right now. And I'd like to take a few minutes just to talk about that, and then I'd be happy to answer any questions that you all have. The Corps of Engineers, National Marine Fisheries Service, and now U.S. Fish and Wildlife, because they are responsible for two of the listed species on the Lower Columbia River, are engaged in a reconsultation process. The ports are participating in that as the designated non-federal representative for the Corps of Engineers. What we have done as a group is, first of all, to work together to commit to trying to work our way through this process on a timeline. We have hired an outside firm. The name of the firm is the Sustainable Ecosystems Institute. And this is a group, it's a public benefit nonprofit corporation that, in essence, works to solve environmental problems through the use of science. What they do is they convene an independent panel of scientists who come together, and in our case, they're going to come together for a series of meetings about a month apart to consider particular issues of concern around this project and address the best available science standard that is required under the Endangered Species Act. We've started that process. The schedule is included on the first page here of the materials that I gave you that shows you the schedule and the meetings that we're having. The way this works, and the reason that it's independent, even though the Corps of Engineers has hired them, we hired them for the first several months to get them started because it took the Corps 120 days to actually get to the point of contracting. But subsequently, the Corps is actually the contractor, but all four entities help govern the management of the contract. We all have a say in what happens in establishing the meetings. The panel was established by SEI putting forward a list of nationally esteemed scientists. All of us had the opportunity to veto any particular scientist if we felt their work or for one reason or another that they weren't appropriate to the panel. So we all had a veto power, but none of us could select the panelists. As we ultimately ended up with a panel of seven scientists that you see listed at the bottom of the page. That group then meets, as I said, on this monthly schedule. They consider the issues. They hear presentations from the Corps, from National Marine Fisheries Service, from U.S. Fish and Wildlife, and from other interested parties if they have science to discuss. This is not a federal or a public process, but it's a science-based review process. The way they describe it is that it's a transparent and open process. It's open for any member of the public to observe. Members of the public can present if they, in fact, have science to present. The panelists will consider the material that's presented and basically have a discussion and give us feedback in terms of what they consider best available science. All of these sessions are videotaped, a record is kept of them, and in addition, the summary of all of the meetings is put up on the internet within 30 days of the conclusion of each of the workshops. And I listed the webpage there for any of you who are interested in visiting the website and keeping up with what's going on with the project. But we've entered into that process because of the concerns that have been expressed throughout the region in terms of the science around the work that the Corps of Engineers had already done. And questions have been raised by downriver communities, by environmentalists, and others, and we want to be sure that we've answered those questions before this project moves forward. I think we all feel strongly enough that it's important to the region, that, and it's important to the region that it's done in an environmentally sensitive way, that we've gone about it to be sure that we do answer those questions, and that the subsequent biological assessment that moves forward into the formal consultation process answers the issues that are of concern after we've gotten the feedback from this panel and gotten their view of what are really the important scientific issues, or maybe where we need to, where best available stands. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you all have. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Perry. Any questions? Senator Yates. Madam Chair. I appreciate your information, but is it possible for you to give us a one-page summary in telling us what has been appropriated during the last 2 years, 3 years, and what you're asking this session, and what is the total investment we are looking at, and let us know how many jobs we expect this will create. What is the cost per job, and what is the return on investment? And I know you have indicated some figures about a 1 to 1.9 benefit ratio, and if you can tell us what is your methodology in arriving at that answer, and what is your goal for the next 2 years?
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, the 1.9 to 1 benefit to cost ratio was the result of the Corps of Engineers feasibility study. I'd be happy to try and provide those answers to you in writing.
Yes. We've been asking every agency to give us a performance measure. So we would be happy to give you an example of a performance measure. We have asked Employment Division to give to us just very recently, so you know what we are asking for in a one-page summary, so we can see exactly what kind of jobs it will create, how much investment we are making, and what kind of return on investment we are looking at.
Mm-hmm. Do you happen to have a copy of the Employment Division performance measures?
You always need to get that from the Employment Department analyst.
Do you mind if we get it from Laurie and supply them?
I can make sure that they get a copy.
Yeah. Thank you.
Other questions, Ms. Perry?
Madam Chair, Keith Levitt with the Port of Portland. I'm not going to, I know we're out of time just about, and just one quick answer to Senator Yee's question about funding this session compared to last couple of sessions.
Yeah, cumulative total.
Yeah, and we'll get you that in writing. The quick answer is that this is a revenue neutral proposition to the legislature this session. What we are asking you to do is to reauthorize the same amount of dollars net that you did in the last two sessions. It's done in a little different way, and we'll go into details, I'm sure, as this budget progresses. The governor made some switches between real lottery dollars that was appropriated in the past to the bonding amount that's in his budget. But the net result is that it's revenue neutral. This is not an added amount of dollars this session compared to what we've asked in the last session.
Not an added amount of dollars, but it will contribute to the total lottery-backed bonding that the state is doing.
And I'm sure that is That is correct. The total amount that we've been asking for two sessions now is $27.7 million. And whether it comes through bonding or through direct lottery, of course, that's up to the legislature. And at the end of last session, the legislature appropriated that amount largely in bonding. $10 million of it was direct lottery, $17.7 million of it was bonding. This session, the governor has taken some of that direct lottery and put it into the bonding amount, but it's the same amount of money, $27.7 million that we're asking for, and that's the same amount that we're asking the Washington legislature to consider as well.
What's the Washington legislature's contribution to this point?
Madam Chair, we've approached the Washington legislature in the same way. $10 million was appropriated two sessions ago. It was subsequently rescinded by I-695, which passed in the state of Washington and affected a lot of their transportation projects. The $10 million was reappropriated, and this session we're also looking for $17.7 million to equal the $27.7 total. We've requested the same set of conditions on the Washington funding as we have on the Oregon, which if each state needs to match the other, that we need a completed project, we need a record of decision, and a project cooperation agreement before funds would be released.
Representative Smith.
What type of container activity does the Port of Portland have versus the Port of Vancouver?
That's a question that there's probably others that could answer better than me. I mean, the container business, excuse me, Madam Chair, Representative Smith, the container business is more to the Port of Portland than to any of the other sponsoring ports, although I understand Vancouver recently got a container crane.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, the Port of Portland does all the container operations on the river right now. Port of Vancouver may end up getting into that business in the future.
Any other questions for Ms. Craig? I have a couple, Ms. Craig. I just want to make sure that I understood you. When you were discussing this very distinguished panel of scientists that were being aggregated to do the analysis or participate in the independent scientific review, you said we had veto power. Who's we?
Each of the four entities, Madam Chair, each of the four entities that are involved in the reconsultation process.
So
that would be the Corps of Engineers, the National Marine Fisheries Service, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and the ports acting as non-federal representatives.
And following along the same line of questioning with this distinguished panel, you said these were all going to be public meetings and the public could present. How will you provide notice of these meetings, and through what portal can the public come? How would they know that there was an opportunity to present? Will there be a solicitation of papers, an opportunity for public testimony? How will you advertise the opportunity?
Madam Chair, the Sustainable Ecosystems Institute has written letters to interested parties or anyone who commented on the project in the past, to environmental groups, to state agencies and others, advised of their role in the of what they're doing in terms of the independent scientific review and inviting people to participate. It is, as I mentioned earlier, it's not a required or like a NEPA process where there's a certain requirement for a series of public hearings. This is, in fact, a transparent process, sort of an environmental mediation process where the public can observe. If the public has science to present, they should contact Sustainable Ecosystems directly. And they've, through the network of people interested in the project, tried to advise about availability. On the other hand, they're not set up or structured to really consider public testimony in the sense of issue-driven public testimony. Their sole goal is to look at best available science, and so they've written, I think, two letters now to environmental groups, state agencies, and others that have expressed interest in the past. I think that list is now up to maybe 60 to 80 people that they are aware of that have had an interest in the project.
My final question is, when you started your testimony, you said part of what you were going to do was to say, what's the project and where are we in the process? And you went through a very comprehensive explanation of where we are in the process. It's my understanding that the reconsultation was in part the result of lawsuits or threatened lawsuits. And I would assume that you have some kind of an idea that at the end of the reconsultation period and the issuing of another opinion, that there may be additional lawsuits. Can you comment on that in terms of the time that those lawsuits would absorb and what kind of a delay that might put on this project?
Madam Chair, there were lawsuits that were filed in February of 2000. Most of the complaints, in essence, that were before Judge Rothstein in Federal District Court in Seattle have been dismissed, except for one, which is there's the complaint against U.S. Fish and Wildlife's terrestrial opinion has been stayed pending the issuance of biological opinion on this project. We would expect that there will be a renewal of litigation, at least in that instance, and perhaps others, once a biological opinion is issued. At the same time, I would also like to say, for the record, one of the reasons that I think all of the agencies involved were interested in engaging Sustainable Ecosystems Institute is they have, for the last 5 years, worked in the Headwaters case in Northern California, where there was actually much more controversy than there is around this project, in that people were, there was physical harm to people, and it was a very controversial situation. And they have worked with the parties, the environmental community, the agencies, the members of the community, and others to the point that the controversy seems to have ended, the physical confrontations have ended. They've worked out a habitat management plan. There has been no subsequent litigation in that instance because they so thoroughly worked to address the public concerns and environmental concerns. That was one of the reasons, one of the features that was attractive to the parties in this instance, because we want to so thoroughly answer the questions that it's our hope that there won't be a basis for concern, assuming that the project gets a positive biological opinion and moves forward.
I was very gratified to hear you say that Eco Northwest had worked with Ecosystems Institute, had worked with the community. What's the plan for this engagement to work with the community?